This is Sick Enough, Part 5, Specific Populations. Many important and unique populations of patients may develop an eating disorder, and Part 5 offers a series of shorter chapters with a case and a discussion of particular groups of patients. Specifically, Part 5 covers type 1 diabetes mellitus, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, ARFID, orthorexia, elite athletes, male patients, gender and sexual minorities, women's sexual and reproductive health, older patients, comorbid substance abuse, and caring for patients who decline treatment. Keep in mind that detailed psychological and sociological considerations for these and many other populations, while out of this medical book scope, have been covered in superb texts. Invariably, some people will read this section and feel missed because they cannot find information here about the important combination of medical issues with their eating disorder. I'm constantly learning from my wonderful patients and colleagues and adding topics for future writing endeavors. I always welcome hearing about unique presentations and challenges. Sick Enough, Chapter 13, Type 1 Diabetes Mellitus and Concurrent Eating Disorders, in brackets ED-DMT1. Case is Anthony. Anthony is a 13-year-old cisgender African-American male who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes mellitus, DMT1, when he was 9 years old. He had been losing weight rapidly and was ravenous and thirsty for 3 months prior to his diagnosis. Ever since the day he went to the hospital and was admitted to the pediatric ICU with critically high blood sugars and diabetic ketoacidosis, multiple medical professionals have warned him about the medical consequences of poor diabetic control. They've talked about the risks of early death, heart attack, blindness, kidney failure, and amputation, threats terrifying to a young boy. In addition, diabetic educators and dietitians over the years have earnestly discussed the dangers of being overweight and the importance of strict dietary control, carbohydrate counting, and intensive tracking of blood glucose. Anthony comes from a family of people with larger bodies, and he has many relatives with type 2 diabetes. He and his mom made a number of changes to their nutrition as a result of his diabetes diagnosis and team recommendations, none of which changed their body's size or shape. Anthony worries a lot about what might happen to him with his diabetes. He also gets teased by peers and feels shamed by doctors for his larger body. The doctors, in particular, have often asked him, "Don't you know what can happen if you don't take care of yourself?" This is confusing because Anthony does feel he takes care of himself. At diabetes camp last summer, some of Anthony's friends told him that they'd learned a trick. If they skipped an insulin shot or decreased the amount of insulin given by their insulin pump, they lost weight. It was like magic. They also taught him ways to fake out his medical team so it looked like he was taking his proper insulin dose. Anthony began to lose weight, and when he returned from camp, family and medical team alike praised him and commented that camp was just what he needed. At this point, though, Anthony doesn't feel too great physically, and he's constantly thirsty, has trouble concentrating, is tired, and feels guilty for deceiving people. However, he does like the positive attention about his weight. The longer he restricts insulin, the more focused he becomes on losing more weight. He feels he's stuck because one weekend when he tried to get back on an appropriate amount of insulin, he became so puffy and swollen that his hands hurt. Anthony's hemoglobin A1C level rises, and he has 2 hospitalizations for diabetic ketoacidosis, DKA, in the course of a month. A hospital dietitian with eating disorder experience sees him during his second DKA admission. She takes the time to sit and ask him compassionately and non-judgmentally about whether he might be deliberately omitting insulin to lose weight. She tells him that this is common and is actually a form of an eating disorder. She notes that help is possible and says she's here to listen. No one has ever asked Anthony whether he might have an eating disorder. He opens up to the dietitian and is referred to an eating disorder team in the community. Background. Let's start with a quick reminder of what diabetes means. Some people believe that eating sugar will cause diabetes, which is incorrect. The pancreas is an organ in the abdomen that has both exocrine, meaning producing digestive juices released through a duct into the intestine, and endocrine, meaning producing hormones released directly into the blood. When a person eats carbohydrates, the pancreas produces insulin. Each body cell derives its energy from the fuel of glucose. Imagine that every cell has a locked door in it. The key to that door is insulin. Without insulin, the door stays locked, and glucose remains in the bloodstream. With insulin, the door unlocks. The glucose enters the cell, and the cell is nourished. 2 types of diabetes. In DMT1, often known as childhood diabetes, the pancreas attacks itself due to an autoimmune process that stops making insulin altogether. Therefore, the only way that glucose can move from the bloodstream to the cells is by injection of insulin. Approximately 1.25 million Americans have DMT1. In type 2 diabetes, known to many as adult onset diabetes, the pancreas still produces plenty of insulin. However, each cell door becomes double bolted. That means that more insulin is needed to open the door, which is referred to medically as insulin resistance. At some point, the pancreas cannot produce enough insulin to unlock all the double bolts. Blood glucose levels rise, and the person is diagnosed with diabetes. Over 29 million Americans have type 2 diabetes. Why high blood sugar matters. With either type of diabetes, the digested and absorbed carbohydrate, now in the form of glucose, remains in the bloodstream rather than entering the cells to energize them. This is medically problematic for a number of reasons. 1, the person functionally starves. Even after eating, glucose calories cannot be used by body tissues because glucose remains in the bloodstream. Rapid weight loss is common, and patients can get sick quite quickly. 2, high blood sugar acts like sandpaper on the most delicate blood vessels in the body, known as the vasculature. These include blood vessels in the brain, heart, healing tissue, kidneys, nerves, and eyes. Over time, constant sanding results in damage, which explains why patients with chronically uncontrolled diabetes are at risk for strokes, heart attacks, foot ulcers that don't heal and may contribute to the need for amputation, kidney failure, nerve pain, autonomic dysfunction, including gastroparesis and blindness. Defining some important concepts. A few medical terms deserve definitions. Normal blood glucose in someone who is fasting ranges from 70 to 100 milligrams per DL, up to 125 milligrams per DL in someone who is not fasting. Hypoglycemia means low blood sugar and usually refers to a glucose level less than 70 milligram per DL. Although in patients with diabetes who have been running higher blood sugars normally, a much higher glucose can feel low. Hyperglycemia refers to blood sugars greater than 180 mg per DL. DKA occurs when the body's cells have had no access to glucose for energy because it all stays in the bloodstream. In response to this starved state, the body breaks down fat and muscle tissue to synthesize glucose, and the byproduct of this breakdown is ketones. Ketone buildup leads to extremely acidic blood, which can cause seizure, coma, or even death if untreated. DKA requires medical hospitalization, often in the ICU. Finally, the hemoglobin, A1C, estimates the average blood glucose level over the past 3 months, weighted toward the most recent few weeks. It is a predictor of morbidity and mortality outcomes. A normal A1C is less than 5.7%, and A1C levels between 5.7% and 6.4% may indicate pre-diabetes in those at risk for type 2 diabetes. It isn't uncommon for patients to have an A1C of 13% or higher at the time of diagnosis. The development of eating disorders in patients with DMT1. Why does skipping or underdosing insulin result in weight loss? There are three major mechanisms. One, when a person with DMT1 skips an insulin dose, they trap all the glucose in the bloodstream rather than allowing it into the cells. Then, through normal blood filtration in the kidneys, glucose is lost into the urine. Patients thus urinate away glucose calories. 2. A high blood sugar draws water from the body tissues into the blood, where it's been filtered and urinated away. This is called an osmotic diuresis. Functionally, it's the same as abusing diuretics 24 hours a day, and the ensuing dehydration causes weight loss. Finally, even while the person is eating, the cells are starving because all the blood glucose remains in the bloodstream. The body therefore breaks down its own tissues in search of glucose, and further weight loss occurs. The DSM-5 mentions insulin omission in its diagnostic criteria for both anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa, but the phenomenon of an eating disorder co-occurring with DMT-1 and deliberate insulin restriction does not receive its own specific designation. Thus, the formal eating disorder diagnosis ends up relating to other findings like body weight and eating disorders. Someone with very low body weight and DMT1 would likely receive the diagnosis of anorexia nervosa, while somebody with a normal or higher body weight and DMT1 would likely be diagnosed with bulimia nervosa, regardless of other purging mechanisms. The overlap between concurrent eating disorders and DMT1, called ED-DMT1 or diabulimia, becomes clear when one realizes that patients have access at all times to a fail-safe mechanism to lose weight. In a society obsessed with weight loss and a patient population often diagnosed between childhood and adolescence, the opportunity to skip insulin can be dangerously irresistible. Dr. Anne Gobel-Fabry is a health psychologist who specializes in diabetes. For a fantastic book about patients with ED-DMT1, I recommend her Prevention and Recovery from Eating Disorders in Type 1 Diabetes. She writes, "Teaching a person how to be a perfect diabetic is akin to teaching them how to have an eating disorder. From childhood, patients with DMT1 are taught to pay attention to meal planning, portion size, carbohydrate counting, and label reading. They receive constant commentary on exercise and weight. Patients may feel chronically deprived by having to follow dietary restraint all the time. They experience a relentless focus on numbers and are judged by doctors and peers based on those numbers. For patients with DMT1 who have inherited temperamental traits of perfectionism, intensity, and anxiety, having these life-threatening consequences of poor diabetic control constantly looming can be overwhelming. In reality, this is a disease in which it's medically impossible to be a perfect diabetic. Even optimal management will result in low and high blood glucose. The body is complicated, and sometimes the glucose is just going to be different than what one expected. The pressure and burnout from constant vigilance and difference from peers can drive patients to think, if I can't be perfect, I might as well be truly imperfect and at least lose weight. Prevalence and consequences of ED-DMT1. How does this translate in terms of the prevalence of ED-DMT1? The statistics are sobering. Women with DMT1 are 2.4 times more likely to develop an eating disorder than their non-diabetic peers. In one study that mentioned patients over 4 years, 29% of young women with DMT1 manifested disordered eating behavior, which persisted in 70%. In a study of preteen girls aged 9 to 13, a full syndrome or sub-threshold eating disorder was identified in 8% of patients with DMT1, compared with only 1% of their non-diabetic peers. Another study showed that 1 out of 3 female and 1 out of 6 male patients with DMT1 reported disordering eating and or frequent insulin restriction. In fact, it is generally agreed that disordered eating or eating disorders, including restriction of insulin, occur in fully 30% of all people with DMT1. Compare this with a general population prevalence of anorexia nervosa of 0.1 to 0.5%, bulimia nervosa of 2%, and BED of 4%. It turns out this higher prevalence matters a lot. Death rates from DMT1 alone are estimated at 2%, and death rates from anorexia nervosa alone are around 6.5%. Death rates from the combination of anorexia nervosa and DMT1 are a devastating 35%. Another study showed that patients with ED-DMT1 were 3.2 times more likely to die over an 11-year study period. They also died an average of 13 years younger than patients with a DMT1 who didn't restrict insulin. Clearly, the co-occurrence of these problems is both prevalent and deadly. Where does this excess mortality come from? Studies have clearly shown that patients with the most tightly controlled diabetes, typically with A1C levels less than 7%, have the same mortality and medical complications as individuals without diabetes. This kind of tight control is very hard to achieve, requires intense work, and causes more episodes of hypoglycemia and more weight gain. By contrast, patients with less tightly controlled, more typical diabetic control have a 30% increased mortality compared with the general population, predominantly from heart attack and stroke. Needless to say, a patient with DMT1 who skips insulin in order to run deliberately high blood sugars for weight loss will have a very high A1C and thus a very high risk of all the associated medical complications. Patients with ED-DMT1 have higher rates of ketoacidosis and more and longer hospitalizations. They also have 2.5 to 5 times more microvascular complications than those with DMT1 alone. Microvascular damage accounts for the majority of diabetes complications. In one study, 25% of patients with DMT1 alone developed retinopathy. By contrast, fully 86% of patients with DMT1 and highly disordered eating behavior developed this serious diabetic complication that can lead to blindness. Managing edema. Treatment of ED-DMT1 is complicated, but it is feasible and vitally worthwhile. It often requires starting in a higher level of care. A number of medical issues must be attended to properly, both for the patient's health and for their trust in the recovery process. One of the biggest barriers to recovering is edema, or fluid retention. This can be intense, uncomfortable, triggering, and persistent. As we have seen, patients with ED-DMT1 who run very high blood sugar levels have a persistent osmotic diuresis, as if they were abusing diuretics at all the time. Even if the individual has never deliberately purged, their body reacts to the chronic dehydration in exactly the same way as in someone who does purge by vomiting, laxative abuse, or diuretic abuse. They develop pseudo-Barter syndrome, as I've detailed in Chapter 9. As you may remember, this refers to overproduction of the adrenal hormone aldosterone, high levels of which make the body retain salt and water. Thus, when patients resume insulin and the excessive urination stops, their body will tend to develop severe edema. Patients may try to get back on track with diabetes care only to gain 10 pounds in 2 days and have none of their rings or clothing fit. It perfectly fulfills the eating disorder's fear that everything will fall apart if we stop using behaviors. Good management of pseudo-Barter syndrome in someone with ED-DMT1 calls for use of the aldosterone blocker spironolactone, usually at the dose of 25 milligrams a day. After a few weeks, the adrenal glands get the message that the body isn't chronically dehydrated anymore, and they downregulate production of aldosterone. Potassium levels need to be monitored weekly in this scenario. Spironolactone may not completely prevent the edema, but it will help reduce it. After all, patients resuming appropriate doses of insulin don't only experience edema from pseudo-Barter syndrome. Insulin itself, as discussed in Chapter 6, causes increased reabsorption of salt and water in the kidneys. Spironolactone won't have an effect on this mechanism. This contribution to edema will go away on its own with time, but patients may need reminders to keep their legs up when seated and a great deal of support and reassurance. Correction of hyperglycemia. The overly fast correction of hyperglycemia is someone with a high A1C can lead to debilitating, years-long nerve pain called neuropathy and worsened eyesight, retinopathy. This is not broadly known by most non-specialist doctors who, from hospital to outpatient settings, believe the best way to serve the patient is to get their blood glucose and A1C levels down quickly in order to reduce morbidity or mortality. In reality, physicians should help patients reduce their A1C fewer than 2 points for every 3-month interval. In the hospital, permissive hypoglycemia or allowance of higher blood sugars should be the standard of care. Choosing a level of care. To remain outpatient for treatment, at a minimum, the patient must be willing and consistently able to take at least their basal, long-acting, insulin and stay out of DKA. If they cannot consistently do this, they must start at a higher level of care. Medical nutrition therapy should emphasize flexible and non-depriving approaches to eating for patients and their families. Most importantly, the treatment team must be aligned and communicative. The endocrinologist should optimally support the patient in becoming a good enough diabetic rather than encouraging them to be a perfect diabetic, which can set off the overwhelm, perfectionism, and all-or-nothing thinking. The dietitian should primarily have an eating disorder background. Many patients have told me that their diabetes dietitians are too rigid and numbers-oriented. The eating disorder dietitian might feel out of scope of practice working with someone who has DMT1, but families can remind them that the doctor will manage the diabetes. What's needed from the eating disorder dietitian is the teaching that there are no off-limit foods and that moderation is safe. Excellent literature details the optimal treatment that patients with ED-DMT1 should receive in higher levels of care. It is vital that patients and families go beyond a program's website assurances of an expertise in diabetes. Asking to speak with the medical director or the head of nursing in advance of admission is imperative. Patients and families can interview them about how their program manages complicated scenarios, and they can ask how many patients with ED-DMTI are presently under the program's care. Additionally, a chronic illness therapy group can be very productive as it allows fellowship and validation of the significant changes of comorbid chronic illnesses with an eating disorder. One of the greatest burdens of ED-DMTI is that once the Herculean effort of recovery from the eating disorder is successfully completed, the diabetes will always be there. In her book, Dr. Gobel Fabry identifies the key markers of recovery from ED-DMT1. Consistently taking one's appropriate insulin doses, not engaging in rigid dieting, overexercising, or intentionally keeping the blood glucose high, eating in a flexible and healthy way most of the time, and not acting on eating disorder thoughts and feelings. Case resolution. Anthony. Anthony is ready to feel better. He knows high school is coming up and he wants to be able to enjoy it. He also feels worried about his health. He meets with his new eating disorder dietitian and therapist, as well as his endocrinologist, within the first week of his hospital discharge. Anthony's endocrinologist apologizes for having missed the signs of ED-DMT1. He acknowledges to Anthony and his mother that Anthony's race, sex, and body size played into internal biases, preventing him from identifying the eating disorder and focusing instead on weight and numbers, and he promises to work on these biases. He puts Anthony on spironolactone 25 milligram a day to reduce some of the edema that has already started to form. The doctor also acknowledges how difficult the edema can be, but that it won't last forever. Anthony works hard over the course of the next year. He makes slow progress on his A1C while benefiting from therapy and from the eating disorder dietitian's refreshing perspectives on food. He no longer feels as deprived. It's exhausting to deal with his diabetes constantly, and at times he feels burned out and rebellious. However, he doesn't take it out on his body anymore. That completes the reading of Sick Enough, Chapter 13.